Welcome to America's Top Rebbetzins. In the merit of this class, may Hashem give a refuah shalema to Tamara bar Elka and also to Devorah bar Hana. And may Hashem watch over all the Jewish people and give enormous strength to the IDF soldiers, including Nachman ben Deganit, Naor ben Libnat, Natalie bat Yahudit, and Nev ben Adi. Please click on the subscribe button to subscribe to us on the America's Top Rebbetzins YouTube page and click follow to follow us on your podcasting app so that you are the first to know when an inspiring new episode is posted. Today, I am happy to welcome Rebbetzin Rivki Herzl. Rebbetzin Rivki is a co-director of Chabad Lubavitch in Zambia, Africa. She is originally from Alaska, where her parents are also Chabad emissaries there. Like Zambia, the Jewish community in Alaska is fairly spread out and it has its own culture. We're going to find out about all the Jewish culture and the community in Zambia today. This is going to be great, a really, really great episode. Thank you so much for being here, Rivki. Please tell us more about yourself and what you do.
Okay, hi. Thanks for having me. I have to say, first of all, not a Rebbetzin. I think you have to reach a certain age for that. thank you for the title. A little bit about myself. So I grew up in Alaska, which I guess to everyone else sounds crazy, but to me was just normal life. My parents moved there in 1991. They were sent by the Rebbe. Maybe we'll go into that a little later, but just in short, they have been there, I guess now it's like 35 years.
Wow.
And obviously started out, you know, just like us, 20-year-old kids, small, you know, Chabad house in the house and, you know, small community. Alaska, I think, is more like normal now, but like then it was like, you know, far and crazy and cold and people didn't know much about it. People didn't just like go there. The Rebbe actually told them that they had gone for Sunday dollars, and the Rebbe told them to machen darten warm, to go make it warm there. That's something that the Rebbe was constantly encouraging them, you know, to not let the cold get to the Yiddish guy, you know, to bring the warmth there. So I grew up there. It was just regular life. I went to online school. I'm not sure if you've heard of it.
Yes.
If you Google, you know, Negri International Online School, it's an amazing thing. It actually started when I was going into first grade. So my older siblings did not have it. They left home much, much younger than I did because, you know, being without the social life, it was too much. They had to go.
Yeah.
For me, you know, I had 19 girls in my class from all over the world, you know, anyone within the somewhat time zone. I mean, I started school at 6 a.m., so I don't know if you would call that normal time zone, but whatever, you know, within, you know, girls from Venezuela, from Florida, anywhere that didn't have a school. Actually, now they opened another division for any Jewish kids, not just Shluchim's kids. So they have a division now for just any Jewish kids that live, you know, families that go to army bases, or even if they have a Chabad where they are, but they don't have a day school yet. So it's an amazing, amazing system. I think everyone kind of got a taste of it in COVID, you know, like putting your kids on Zoom. The difference is that when you start like that, when you're in first grade, it's not like going from like real school to online school. It's a little bit easier. Like, I mean, it depends on the personality of the kid. Not every kid does well with it, but for me, I loved it. I learned. I had lots of friends. We had a serious social life, as crazy as that sounds. You know, we had fights and we had all the drama that you would have in regular school, maybe even more.
Online?
Online, everything online. We would sit, you know, it was like beating the security system of the school so that you can go on Gmail chat. And how can you do it without the teachers, you know, realizing? So it was like a whole, it's like a whole thing. It's like a whole group, and it's a life. I mean, the kids of that, it's just the best school. I taught there. I went back and did programming for them. And it's just, you're dealing with a bunch of kids that are in the craziest places, you know, in the craziest situations, and they don't even know it. You know, like when you're growing up with it, it's so normal. It's just so obvious. Like, of course we live here. There's no like, oh, I wish I could live where there's kosher ice cream. Like it doesn't even dawn on you. It's just like, it's just how it is. It's just like the normal life.
And where in Alaska? I know you were in Alaska, but which city in Alaska? Where were you in?
Anchorage. It's like basically the main, I mean, it's not the capital, but it is pretty much the main city, the biggest city.
Anchorage. Okay. Okay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So What else? I have 3 siblings. 2 of them moved back to my parents. One works with my parents, and the other one opened the Chabad house an hour away from us in a place called Wasilla. My other brother heard of it.
Yes.
Really?
Wasilla, Alaska. Yes, I have heard of it.
That's interesting. Okay. It's a smaller place. And then I have another brother that moved to Budapest. He joined the Chabad there.
Beautiful.
And then I'm the youngest. That's it.
And you're the youngest in Zambia, Africa.
In Zambia. Exactly.
Oh my gosh.
Yes.
We're going to talk a lot about this today because I think it really is so cool that you are a Chabad emissary in Zambia and that your parents are Chabad emissaries in Alaska. I mean, people are always curious about what really happens behind the scenes at Chabad, you know, and you're the perfect person to ask, you know, the following questions. Because there are Chabad centers all over the world, as we were saying, there are Chabad centers everywhere in Japan, in Peru, in Nigeria, in Mexico, in Canada, everywhere,
yeah.
even in the island of the Caribbean. You know, how is it decided where a new Chabad center will open, and how are people selected to become the Chabad emissaries? And also, if you can please explain to us what is involved in opening the Chabad center, like from A to Z, from being selected and to actually opening.
Okay, so in general, people always wonder, do you have a choice? Which I guess what's funny about that is, like, I think that people who are not from and don't go through the shidduchim system also wonder that, you know, do you have a choice in your shidduch?
Right.
And I think finding shidduchim is very much kind of like the shidduch system, actually. Back in the day, the way it started, you know, when the Rebbe really first started sending the first shidduchim, the Rebbe sent them, you know. The Rebbe sent my grandfather to Detroit, Michigan. The Rebbe sent, you know, the Gorelick family to Italy, to Milan. You know, the Rebbe sent those first few, like, pioneers, I guess you call them. But very, very quickly, the Rebbe changed the system. And people were not happy about it because there's something really nice about just being sent. Like, you know, that's the right way. Like, that's the right choice. You have this confidence that, like, you know, if the Rebbe told me to do it, then for sure it's the right thing. So people kind of kicked back a little bit, but the Rebbe started that, you know, everyone has to just figure it out on your own. So the Rebbe gave them a bracha. Like, when my parents went, they wrote on a piece of paper a couple of options. The Rebbe circled Alaska, and that was it. But they essentially chose what they were interested in, you know, what the options, which options they were interested in, what they were looking for. You know, you had a choice. And the Rebbe really wanted that, I think, because shluchas is something that you really need to have a passion for. You really have to feel connected to it. You know, people, like, the first reaction that people have to most conversations with shluchim is, wow, that's such mesiras nefesh. You know, that's like the term. Which, you know, I in some ways, I understand that. For me, mesiras nefesh, you know, is explained in different places in Chassidus of, you know, mesiras nefesh is mesiras haratzen, you know, giving over your will, giving up on your will, giving up on your life. And to me, this is the only life I want to live. So 100%, there's so many challenges. And I'm, you know, we're dealing with things that, you know, you never have to deal with if you lived in New York or Florida, like, not a doubt. But it's something that we look for. It's something that we want to do. You know, when Lubavitch couples are going out, I would say 80% of the conversation is about shluchos.
Really?
Like, because, yeah, I think, first of all, because there's so much, it's so much a part of our life. You know, even if you're a Lubavitcher and you don't move on shluchos somewhere, the Rebbe educated us to each be a shliach, not only if you have the title of shliach, you know, in Zambia, in Alaska. This is really a new way of looking at the world, a new like a mission statement for our generation that, you know, it's not enough to just, like, sit at home and, you know, learn Torah for yourself and keep your own Shabbos. And if you're not giving that to others, you know, what purpose does it have anymore? This is the only way that we can bring Mashiach, is to give it to others. So a huge part of the conversation is shluchas. Do you want to go? What kind of shluchas do you want to go on? And, you know, you're obviously not going to, if someone wants to stay in Crown Heights, you know, it's not going to work to if someone else wants to go to Zambia. So it's definitely a big part of the conversation. But yeah, a lot of it's all about, you have, you know, you choose it. If there's a big fight over places, because the world is getting smaller and smaller and Chabad is getting bigger and bigger, and you have less options. You know, you can't be so picky. You got to just go where there's a need. You know, it's not like you can't have a checklist and say it has to have A and B and C and D. You know, you just, if you're going for the mission, if you really want it, then you're going to find something and you're just going to go with whatever it is. But you have to have a passion for it. It has to be something you feel connected with. So there's definitely like networking systems, you know, WhatsApp groups. I'm looking for a couple to come join us to do A, B, and C. So like there's for sure like things like that. For us personally, we sat down with the Google Maps, opened it. We looked at cities, at countries. We called the head shluchim of each place, you know, whoever is like in charge of that region or whatever it is. Ask them if they're looking for people. Does the place have a need? Sometimes you have to convince them that there's a need because, you know, they're so focused on their own Chabad house and their own shluchas. They're too busy. They can't even start to look for the other, you know, the other cities. Like my parents now are looking for couples to move down to other cities in Alaska. It's only after 35 years. There's so much that goes into building up your own place. Sometimes you have to convince them, like, come on, I checked it up. I know there's enough Jews there. We have to make it happen. So for us, we actually found Zambia a couple weeks after our wedding. The head shlucha to Central Africa passed away, Mrs. Miriam Bentolila. She was sick for, I think, 2 years. And during her Shiva, her husband made an announcement on like all the Chabad news sites that in her memory, he's going to bring a couple down to a new country, to Zambia. So we didn't really think much of it at the time, you know, kind of just passed by our radar. But then a couple months later, when we started looking into places, somehow every place that we looked into, every offer that we got, we kept on getting pulled back. Like, I can't even explain it. It's a connection. It's, you know, like a shidduch. It really is. So after a few months of, you know, discussing it and looking into it, we made tickets to go visit. We arrived the night before Purim, literally 24 hours before. We made two parties in just 24 hours. There was a really amazing family here that helped us, you know, get everything set up and figure out where to go, helped us find the house to live in. And then that's it. And we, you know, we visited for 2.5 months. And by the end of it, you know, the head shliach was like, okay, like, what do you think? What's the conclusion? And, you know, we thought about it. We went back and forth. And, you know, we were here for a long enough time. Not everyone goes to visit for 2.5 months. But when you're going to Africa, it's you need to really experience it. You know, you really need to live there for an amount of time to really know what you're getting yourself into, and make sure that you're really ready for it. And we sat down. We wrote a letter to the Rebbe and we said, you know, I remember like 3 o'clock in the morning, we're like, that's it, we're just going to do it. You know, we're like, you know, we know we're aware of the challenges. We know what goes into this, but we want to take it on. And that's it. And that's how it happened. So I don't know what else behind the scenes do you want to know about it?
So there was like no like one person who sends you, okay, you go here. You know, you just really.
No, it's something that has to come from you. You're not sent, okay, by anyone. It's not everybody goes. A huge percentage does, but not everyone does. And it's something you have to want to do. I mean, it's not enough to just even to grow up in it. You know, many children of shluchim don't go. It has to be something that you, a passion and a desire that you grow on your own from learning and from maturing and figuring out that this is something you want to do for yourself, you know, because it's a life mission. And the only way that you can get through, there are challenges, you know, and the only way that really gets you through them is that knowledge of, I chose this, I want this. You know, that's what drives you. That's what motivates you. You know, we looked into so many different options. Like my parents, when we told them, you know, we're in Zambia, we're coming to visit there, like, you couldn't find anything closer. Right. I was like, listen, you can't complain. You left your mother in Israel to go to Alaska. Like, I'm sorry. Right. You have no right. but you have to, that's, I don't know. It's like a shift. We felt a connection to it. It's something that there's something here the need, I think, was what drove us. You know, the other places we looked into, there were a lot of different couples looking into it. We weren't the only one. When it came to Zambia, there were other couples that tried it out and decided it wasn't for them. And there really wasn't anyone lining up. It wasn't like, you know, there aren't, yeah, the lines weren't very long. And I think that's what drove us, you know, the feeling of, this is where we could really make a difference. There's really a need here. If we don't do it, how many years will it take till someone goes there? What about, you know, when you go to somewhere like Africa, it's a very transient community. People are constantly moving in and out. So it's a very different, it's a very different kind of goal that you have. You know, when you go to anywhere, Florida, Alaska, whatever, it doesn't matter, anywhere in America, or even Europe, there's a growth mindset, kind of. You know, you start a preschool with 5 and you hope that it will go to 10 and maybe in 30, you know, and you're hoping that it's going to, when you move somewhere like here, every year the Chabad house changes. And you just have to go with the flow of the needs. Some year you'll have a preschool, some years you'll have a Hebrew school, some years there will be no kids and it will just be adults. And it's just this constant. So there is a small community here, like a very old community that goes back, you know, 100 years. So there are some people that live here permanently, but the majority are constantly in and out.
And who are these people that are in and out? So there's the Zambians who just live there, the Jewish ones who they're a permanent part of the community. But then who do you have going in and out?
So a lot of business people come with their families. And then just depending on, you know, what kind of business it is or how successful it is, that's how long they stay. So we have families that are here for 15 years, for 20. We have some that are here for 2, for 5. And then there's also people in the embassy, the British Embassy, the American Embassy, coming for 2-3 years at a time, and then they go. And so it's a different approach. You know, you're looking at it as, how can I touch someone's life in these 2 months, 2 years, one day even? You know, we didn't come here expecting that, you know, in 10 years, it's going to be hundreds.
Right.
It's going to stay in the same, very, it's going to stay very small.
Right, because that's the nature of your community.
Exactly. On the other hand, you have touched thousands.
Yes.
Because there's constantly people coming in and out, in and out, in and out. And you don't always know where people end up and what you gave them and what lit their spark. So you just don't know.
Right. It's 100%. And so how long have you been there?
So we were a little bit in and out for a while. We visited when I was pregnant with my first. And we came here when he was 6 months old. So there was like a big gap of time till we managed to come, till we got like visas and passports and, you know, all the things. And then 6 months later, we left again to have my second. And I actually went home to Alaska to give birth. So we were out for another 3 months. And then we just came back like a month and a half ago. So we kind of been here for 2 years, but like permanently, you know, 8 months, 9 months.
Okay. And how did you, to establish a house, like an actual Chabad house, how is that, you know, because do you have to go through government regulations? Do you need approval? Like, how is that?
So in every place it's different. We're here. I mean, also it's not America. It's like different countries. So every country has their own, like, you know, you go on a work permit or this kind of visa. It's like, just kind of depends on where you're going. But actually, like, establishing it, you know, we made sure that we had a house. We had to do fundraising, make sure that we have enough to cover, you know, at least 1 year's budget, you know, which includes flights to mikvah, you know, Shabbos dinners every week, having a roof over our heads, the electricity.
The basics,
And the basics, and then as well as many programs as we possibly can budget for. It's a process till you can settle down, but that's really all there's to it. You kind of come fresh off the boat and you just start, you just do what you can. It's kind of like, you know, every place is so different. The kind of people you have are so different. When you're in a foreign country, what's kind of cool about it is that we're all foreigners together.
Yes.
And so we're all looking for friendship and support and a place to call home.
Yes.
It's different than when you're going to America and everyone kind of has their life and that's it, you know? So very different kind of thing, but yeah, no, not really that many secrets going to it.
But then you have so many challenges, because I imagine you don't have kosher food. Like, there's no seasoned supermarket. There's no gourmet glut. Like, what? How do you get your food?
So actually, right here behind me, I don't know how much you see. It's just the beginnings of a kosher store. We called it the Makolet.
Oh, wow.
Yes. You see like a freezer there.
Yes.
What else do you see? Freezers, refrigerators.
Yes.
You know, bringing in products. We bring it in from South Africa.
Okay.
And it took a little process to figure out, you know, what's the best way. And we'll be constantly changing and shifting till we figure it out. You know, bringing meat and wine into the country is illegal. So you have to have special permits. You have to convince them it's for Jewish reasons, religious reasons. So we have a permit to do it. And we have a cooling truck now that brings it in. So we have them freeze it completely before they send it. It goes into the cooling truck. And then you have to hope it's not stopped by the borders. And if it's stopped by the borders, it can sit there. So the way we've been doing it before, when it came on just a regular car or truck, it was very scary because you could lose thousands of dollars worth of meat. Hopefully now with this cooling truck, we'll take away that concern. Hopefully nothing will happen to it.
Yes.
But yeah, that's how we get kosher food. And now we just started this small little store, you know, bringing in bamba, tchina, meat, chicken, giving everyone, you know, it's there's two parts to it. There's the people that are keeping kosher already and need an easier way to do it. You know, there's tourists that come that are Shomer kosher people. And then there's people that are like, you know, wouldn't have done it otherwise, but it's here, it's next door, it's easy. And why not once in a while to buy a kosher chicken, you know? So it's special. It's a very cool thing.
Very nice. Okay. Wow. And it's so cool that you have a store, because not many places have stores, even some Chabads in America, like they don't have stores.
So it's much less common in America, because in America, you can find a lot in stores.
It's true. But you know, my husband and I, we travel the country. Like, we're trying to visit all 50 states. So if you're yes, I agree. In New York, on the East Coast, in Florida, yes. But if you're going in the middle of nowhere, for example, let me give you an example. We were in, we visited four states this summer. What do we visit? We visited Nebraska, Missouri, Kansas, and Iowa. That's four states in one trip.
I have family everywhere there. Yeah, go ahead.
I should have asked you.
all my aunts and uncles are shluchim. Name a place. You got it.
So maybe you'll know them. The only kosher restaurant, the only kosher place that we could find is in Des Moines. There was a Chabad of Des Moines, and they run a little deli.
Yes.
You know what I'm talking about. Yes. So that's it was like the only place where we could sit down and just like have a normal meal out of the whole week.
Right. So, okay, we don't have a restaurant yet. That will take a long time.
Okay.
But yeah, I mean, even in America, okay, so even if you don't have a deli to sit down by, you have, I'm talking just like corn chips, peanut butter, you know, like you're not going to starve. So we're actually pretty lucky from all the African shulchan, we have the most, because we're right next to South Africa. And so a lot of the chain stores from South Africa are here as well. So we have almost everything, like any like regular products. I mean, for me, it's going to be weird because everything tastes different. So not because it's Zambia, but even in South Africa, it would be hard for me to get used to, you know, like a different tomato sauce and a different ketchup and a different mayonnaise, you know, like these kind of things.
Yes.
But we do have a lot. So, you know, meat, dairy, pâté sirop, we bring it in.
Okay.
But otherwise you could get things here, but that is why many shluchim outside of America are much more quick to start like a store or a restaurant, a deli. It's like, just happens more often.
That makes sense. This makes a lot of sense. And so that's with the food. But I know you were saying about like flying to the mikvah. So you don't actually have a mikvah where you are.
Don't have a mikvah. It's absolutely the first priority project. It's the project that takes the longest.
Yes.
But it's a priority project. Not only because for me, because, you know, flying with my baby and a 2-day trip and it's a pain, but not only that, you know, it's the most important. I mean, it comes before a shul. It comes before anything. It's the most important part of Jewish life, you know, taras mishpacha and having a Jewish family. So it's 100% our first goal. But yeah, for now, there's no mikveh.
And you fly to South Africa?
Fly to South Africa.
Okay.
Which is only 2 hours. I mean, there's shluchas to fly 10 hours to South Africa. So I'm very lucky.
Okay.
There are no night flights. So it is like a 2-day situation.
Okay.
And yeah, it's an interesting experience. Hopefully soon we'll have a mikvah here.
Yes. Oh, I mean, I really, really hope so. I hope so. So what are the, so you have the food, you have to fly to mikvah, but you have minyanim, right? Do you have like 3 minyans a day? Do you have enough people for that or?
Not at all. No, not at all.
Okay.
You know, it's funny. Even in Alaska, we have a much bigger Jewish community in Alaska. There's definitely enough men to bring together a minyan 3 times a day. What's different is that it's not necessarily important to them. And when we're setting up a Chabad, our first, what we're looking to do is to see, what do people need? You know, I'm sure my husband would love to have a minyan 3 times a day.
Of course, yeah.
It would be nice to even have a minyan every Shabbos. That would already be a start.
Oh, wow. Okay.
yes. But that's not what people need. That's not what the people are looking for. You know, everyone's on their own level in Judaism. Everyone is in their own comfort level in Judaism. Not everyone's comfortable with the shul. You know, just the whole setup. There's the mechitza. That's hard for people to swallow. You know, not everyone's comfortable with that yet. And we're just looking for, what do people need? What are people going to connect to? Is there a group of people that want a preschool for their kids? I'll make a preschool. Is there a group of kids that want a Hebrew school? We'll make a Hebrew school. Do they just want to do holiday events and anything else is too much? Sure. They want to just come to the store and, you know, that's it. Pick up some kosher food and go home and not be too involved. No problem. It's whatever people are going to feel connected to, whatever is going to spark their neshama. So minyan in most communities, I would say most Chabad houses in smaller places do not have a minyan. Not only not every day, but not even necessarily every Shabbos. That's something that grows. But there's not really an interest for it. You know, we're not here to force the Yiddish guide on people. You know, okay, we want to give them whatever they feel comfortable with. It's, you know, we're not on a mission to make them be like us or even to become from tomorrow. It's about every mitzvah and, you know, whatever they're going to feel connected to, really. So minyan is definitely not the first year. That's for sure.
Okay.
So for some people it is, there is a group of people that are really interested in it.
Okay.
And to do it as much as possible, but it's, you know, the group that wants it is not necessarily big enough to actually make it happen on their own. They need to pull in others.
Right.
So it has to come with the interest. So maybe one day.
Right. Hopefully. Yes. Yes. And like, what do you embrace the most about being in Chabad of Zabia, like in your community with the people? Like, what do you love the most?
I think the best part, I think that this is what pushed us to come here, is first of all, the openness to there's nothing. You know, when you're coming to something that is, it's like you're coming to an empty land and you can just do whatever you want, plant whatever you want. It's you have this like open, empty landscape of just do whatever could be done. So on the one end, it's also, there's something hard about it because, you know, when you're doing like a 9-to-5 job, there's a beginning and an end, and then it ends, and then you go home and it ends. It's a 24-hour life, and which is amazing. I mean, once you obviously there's like a balancing act and you have to learn, but there's so much need and there's so much purpose and there's so much that could be done. And we could sit here and, you know, you would think, what are you doing all day? You know, how many Jews do you have already? 60 Jewish families, 80 Jewish families? I don't even know. I can't even give you a number. But somehow we're so busy because there's so much that could be done. And it doesn't matter if there's 5 people or 10 people. It doesn't make a difference because if you're, you know, if we're coming here for every single neshama, who cares? What difference does it make if your Purim party has 2, has 10, has 50, has 100, 300? You never know who you're touching, who you're giving the mitzvah of hearing the Megillah to, which, you know, which Jewish kid, maybe they'll leave tomorrow, but they'll always have that memory of that, you know, positive Jewish experience of having a positive Jewish interaction, even, you know, just, it's amazing. It's like, there's just this constant never ending you feel the fulfillment, but then there's always this like, we could do more. Like it's just like, it's never stale. It never gets old. I see it with my parents, like you stay young forever in a certain way because of it, because there's no retirement. It's just always, you know? So I think for me, that's what I love the most. There's just so much to be done.
And it's so beautiful. And I love like the point of what you're saying is like every Jew matters, even if it's just one. It doesn't have to be 500 Jews in a room to matter. One Jew 100%. In a room matters. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. And like, it's crazy what, you know, I'm sure, you know, Rabbi Sachs, right? Rabbi Jonathan Sachs. So, you know, I love hearing his speeches and the stories he tells about the Rebbe. Have you ever heard any of them?
No, but please share.
So, I mean, I could just start with, you know, in short, you know, he was in university, he went to the Rebbe. I don't remember all the details of, you know, his life story, but he asked the Rebbe what he should do. You know, he had a few options, different jobs, you know, he could be a professor, he could be, I forgot even what they were. And the Rebbe said, and he had already had smicha, he was already a rabbi. And the Rebbe told him, you know, forget the options, go teach other people how to be rabbis. And Rabbi Sachs said, you know, later on how he sees how he really got everything that he wanted, you know, from taking his life. And instead of going to do all those things that would make him feel bigger and make, you know, feed his ego and do the things that he wants, he focused on other people. And with that, he got everything he wanted in the end. He also became a professor and also became a lecturer and also became a teacher. You know, he also got his doctorate. He had everything together. Wow. And he talks about his different life experiences and the different things that the Rebbe taught him and told him that had such an effect on his life. You know, like I know one story that the Rebbe told him, you know, every Jew is a flame and you have to go and light, you know, every Jew is a candle, you have to go and light their flame. And you have no idea who you're going to touch. You know, me, you know, speaking to one person, you have no clue who that person is going to go on to inspire. It's endless. It's endless. The ripple effect is endless. And I think when you're in a small community, you feel that even more because you don't get lost with the numbers. You don't be like, oh my God, we had 100 people at this. You don't get lost with that. You're really, really focused on every person. How can I change his life for the better? How, you know, whether it's physically or spiritually, it doesn't matter. You know, we're here for every Jew, whatever they need. And even for the non-Jewish community, you know, we're doing, in a couple of weeks, we're doing a Prayer for Israel event. And the interest that we've seen from the non-Jewish community in coming to show their support and pray together and you know, unite for the Jewish people, it gives them so much purpose, and they're so excited to come together for a good cause. It's amazing. You never know who you're inspiring. You never know, you know, we're walking in the street, people can see that we're Jewish in the middle of Africa. You have no idea who's gonna pass by and see us, you know, even if they don't come over to us. There's so many stories of these things that, you know, people found out 35 years later, the effect they had. You don't always see those happy endings. And you just have to like really remember that they're there.
That's so beautiful. It's really, really beautiful because you're passionate about doing this. You're passionate about touching the lives of these Jewish people. And you know, like, I just feel like, you know, that they're one Jew leads to another, you know, it all rubs off on us, you know, and we're all connected.
For sure. 100%. You know, I mean, even the things you do in your home, I just saw recently, you know, we're actually going to South Africa tomorrow. We were invited to speak to the Chabad High School there for their Shabbaton.
Very nice.
So we were, you know, preparing for it, and I'm doing a workshop on Hasidic feminism for them. And so I was looking up, you know, different things that the Rebbe speaks about women and the job of women and the role of women in Judaism. And one of the things that the Rebbe really emphasizes is the feminine energy and the feminine quality that the men don't have, that you see it when you walk into someone's home, and you can see what the woman's energy is based on the father and the children. And not only that, the Rebbe goes on to say that not only does she affect her whole entire home, but she's also affecting all the people on her street. That the people in the neighborhood, even the non-Jews in the neighborhood, will feel the energy that she gives to her home, if it's an energy of peace, of kindness, of love, of warmth. So, you know, it's like, You've no idea. It's amazing.
Amazing. Wow. Wow. And we have time for one last question. I love stories. And thank you so much for sharing the ones that you have shared. But I was wondering if maybe you have stories from some of the people in your community, either the ones that live there permanently or some who have come and gone. I just love this.
Yes. Just warning, our electricity just went out. Welcome to Zambia. Okay. If this goes out, I will call back on my phone, but let's see if we can finish quickly.
Okay.
So I could tell you about, you know, one Jew that I was just thinking about. We had Bachrim here that came because we couldn't be here because I was having a baby. And they went to visit Victoria Falls, which is beautiful falls, like a 7-hour drive away from us. And they just went to meet one Jewish family. We asked them, you know, can you go? You'll enjoy the vacation. Go meet this one Jewish family that we know. And in the airport, they bumped into this guy, an old Jew, been living there for years. Now he lives like in the middle of Kenya somewhere, like in the jungle. And he was so, you know, when's the last time he saw a Jew in his life? And he was so excited by seeing them. They put on tefillin with him. I probably didn't put on tefillin in what, 60, 70 years. And now he's in touch with us. You know, he sent my husband a message. I think it was right after October 7th, you know, his neshama was just turned on. Like, what could I do for, what could I do for the Jewish people? What could I do for God? What can I do today? You know, like he was so, just that one little encounter that, which would never have happened. I mean, we haven't been there yet, you know, going with two babies, like we never would have made it there, but just, you know, Hashgacha Pratis happened to be, I was having a baby and we needed to bring young Bachrim with more energy than us. And they went to this airport and they met this Jew and they got him involved, got him connected just by seeing them walking around, you know, with their black hats and their tzitzis. And they just, his neshama woke up. It's like, it's amazing.
So beautiful. So beautiful. Thank you. And thank you so much, Rebbetzin Rivki, for joining us on America's Top Rebbetzin and the Meredith class. May Hashem give a refuah shalema for Tamara Bar Elka and Devorah Bar Hana. And also may he give enormous strength to the Jewish people and the IDF soldiers, including Nachman ben Deganit, Naor ben Libnat, Natalie Bat Yehudit, and Nev ben Adi. Thank you so much again.
Thank you.